Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Welcome to West Hills Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. My name is Liz, and I'll be your lay leader today. I want to welcome everyone who is here in the sanctuary and also those who are at home watching our recording. I want to welcome our visitors and our founding members. I want to welcome those seeking comfort or support and those seeking fun and lightness. I want to welcome you if you are tired in your body and need rest. I want to welcome you if you are tired in your heart and need community. I want to welcome you if you look at me and see someone different, or if I can be a mirror for you to see yourself. I want to welcome you as we recognize that Washington County and the rest of the world is still experiencing a pandemic. And while we can't cure you if you are ill, we can heal you here in other ways. We ask that while inside the building, on our beautiful grounds, you wear masks, and that if you have any symptoms of illness, you stay home and watch our services online. In light of that, we ask that you consume food and beverages outside during coffee hour, or if you're watching from home, please consider joining our coffee hour over Zoom. The link for that is in your order of service. If you're so inclined, you can also find more space and the service being streamed downstairs. If you're in the sanctuary, you might notice that we've had a turnover in our art, which is featuring families here at WUF, so please enjoy that. And this week's announcements are listed in the attachments of the order of service email. Please now enjoy our opening music. Now, Virginia and Larry, if you would please come and light our chalice for us, and we will say our words of affirmation. Let us open our eyes to see what is beautiful and what is wondrous. Let us open our minds to know what is true and what is mysterious. And let us open our hearts to love one another and our neighbors. Thank you. Today's service is about health care, and as Scottish philosopher Thomas Carlyle once said, he who has health has hope, and he who has hope has everything. I know that as we navigate our way through a brand new world that has been irreversibly changed by the global pandemic, we will find hope. And maybe in some ways we know that it is hope that has sustained us all along. Now is the time for all ages.
Wash your hands before you eat.
Wash your hands before you eat.
Brush your teeth after every meal.
Brush your teeth after every meal.
See your doctor and your dentist.
See your doctor and your dentist.
We all need checkups, no matter how good we feel. Oh, how lovely life will be if we keep the Ten Commandments of Health.
Commandments of Health.
Cover your nose whenever sneezing.
Cover your nose whenever sneezing.
Cover your mouth when you're coughing too.
Cover your mouth when you're coughing too.
Dress warmly in cold weather.
Dress warmly in cold weather.
And you won't have much coughing or sneezing to do. Oh, how lovely life will be if we keep the Ten Commandments of Health. Health, oh sweet health, it's what mother fame or wealth to me. One thing I say a lot, take care of the life you've got. It's such a precious commodity.
keep in shape.
Bathe or shower when each day is through.
Bathe or shower when each day is through.
Eat lots of fruits and vegetables.
Eat lots of fruits and vegetables.
Give your body all the treatment that it's due. Oh, how grand we're gonna feel, 'cause we'll keep the 10 commandments of hell.
Commandments of hell.
Today we have a guest speaker, Rick Stagenborg. Did I say your name right? Should have asked that before. He's going to talk to us about healthcare for all Oregon and how we can get involved to aid the cause. And after his talk, we'll have time for a few minutes for questions from the congregation, both here in person and at home.
I'm going to time myself to try to keep this on time because I don't like practicing my talks. Thank you for having me here. I want to thank Karen Stratton, who's a member of the Faith Caucus for Healthcare for All Oregon. And I want to thank everyone who went along with the decision to have me speak today. I think your interest in this topic shows that this is a fellowship that lives by the second principle, which, of course, is based on the first principle, the inherent worth and dignity of everyone, for those of you who haven't memorized them. And the struggle for justice is the way I think about the second one. So I used to be a UU member, just so you know, but I'm going to... We don't have one in my town that I live in now, but I'm going to share my interpretation of a story from the Bible, my favorite story, which is that of a Good Samaritan. I think that probably everybody here has the main message of it, which is basically it boils down to the golden rule, but I think there's a little more that can be said about it that's interesting. And after that, I will talk about Healthcare for All Oregon and the Faith Caucus and what you can do to get involved in our efforts to bring health care to everyone who lives in Oregon when they need it, regardless of their ability to pay. I apologize that I didn't take that off. I hope you could understand what I just said. Okay. Well, anyway, for those of you who aren't familiar with the story of the Good Samaritan, it's one of those stories where Jesus is confronted by one of the legal scholars who are, in other words, scholars of the Torah who interpret the law according to the Torah. And he says, "So, Rabbi, how can I be assured of eternal life?" And Jesus says, "Well, what does the law say?" And the response is, "Well, it's love thy God with all thy heart, thy soul, thy spirit, their mind, and all thy strength." So, Jesus says, "Great answer. That's right. You know the law well." And then the legal scholar says, "Well, but who is my neighbor?" And Jesus says, "Well, let me tell you a story. There was a man who was waylaid on his way, and he was beaten and left by the side of the road. So a priest walks by and grabs his garments and skirts way around him because he doesn't want to be ritually contaminated. Same thing with the next guy that comes by who's a Levite. That's another church official or synagogue official, I should say. Moves around. And then along comes a Samaritan. Now, the Samaritans were people that weren't popular with the Israelites. They had serious differences, the Israelites of that time, I should say. And so he stopped, and he bound the wounds, stopped the bleeding, put the man on his donkey, and walked along with him to the inn, and put him up in the inn, gave the inn owner some money to care for him, and came back the next day to check on him. So that's the basic story, and most people say, okay, well, that's what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to help people when they need it. So that's the obvious message. Or to put it another way, which is, I think, the essence of all great religions, is do unto others as you would have them do unto you. So great. I think everybody here probably gets that and probably tries to live by that. Well, let's look at that a little bit closer. First of all, the tradition up until that time, or at least as I understand it, I'm not a Jewish scholar, but there is a very famous story of Rabbi Hillel, who lived in the century before Jesus and into Jesus' life, actually. And he, someone once asked him, he says, well, Rabbi, can you tell us what's in the Torah while standing on one foot? And so, I hope I can do this without falling over. And so he says, don't do unto others that which you would not have done unto you. The rest is commentary. Which I just love that. Because I think I think that's the way the whole Bible is, you know. The rest is commentary. If you start there, everything else makes sense. I mean, what I mean to say is, if you interpret things you read in the Bible that aren't consistent with that, you're misinterpreting. I mean, not that I'm any kind of biblical scholar, or certainly not a literalist, but a lot of people do think that way. And they just focus on the wrong things. To me, that's where you start. That's the beginning. As the UU principles begin with that, 1 and 2. So another major theme, obviously, is that everyone is your neighbor. You don't pick and choose. It doesn't mean literally the people that are right in front of you that you live with, that you might depend on someday. It means everybody, you know. Everybody has that worth and dignity. So another major lesson out of this, and I think the story of Rabbi Hillel emphasizes this, is that when they say love your neighbor, that's an action word. It just doesn't mean have an attitude of love. It means do. Help them when they need it. And so that was a change from the teachings of Rabbi Hillel, if that story reflects his basic teaching. Again, I'm not a scholar. So I just wanted to tell that little story to motivate you, because the real reason I'm here is to talk to you about why we need universal health care, what Health Care for All Oregon is doing to make that happen, the role of the Faith Caucus, and how you personally can get involved, both as individuals and as a congregation. So let me start with Health Care for All Oregon. It's an organization that's been going on for a long, long time, working on this issue that's so big it sounds aspirational. We're trying to get a publicly funded universal health care system that gives high quality, comprehensive care to everyone who needs it in an equitable way, and that's affordable. So we've looked at the studies, and we've looked at systems that have universal health care in other countries, and some that are kind of universal health care in the United States. And what we see is that these systems are always cheaper. So there's an easy economic argument for that. You can get higher quality health care than we have in the United States with less money, if your values are such that you recognize everybody deserves this. Seventh principle, interdependence. That's where those cost savings come in. So people have to be educated about that sometimes, but when I speak to a faith congregation, of course, the real focus is going to be on moral principles. I don't think that's a tough sell in this audience. So, I mean, you guys are already involved in a lot of stuff, like every UU congregation that I've come across. So Healthcare for All Oregon has this big goal, and people might think, well, yeah, but you've been working at it for a long time, and, you know, we're not any closer. We got a president that says he will veto legislation that's passed by Congress if it includes universal health care, or at least a single-payer system. And I think, unfortunately, that's a measure of how corrupt the system is. I'm not calling the president corrupt particularly. It's a corrupt system where people are elected the people that we get to vote for, they're there in front of us and have the publicity so that we know their names and the media attention, because people give them a whole lot of money to run. It's a pay-for-play system. It's not fair, and it doesn't put the needs of the people first. So that's what we're up against, and I can understand why some people might think that we really don't have a chance. But the fact of the matter is we've come a long, long ways, and most people don't know it, and that's one of the reasons I'm here, to let you know how close we've come. So the legislature passed in, I think it was 2009, a moratorium declaring their intent to eventually have a universal health care system in the state, a state system, as opposed to going for a federal right away. Well, that was great, but then we had to prove that it was cheaper, so we asked them to authorize a study to prove it, as it has in every study that's looked at it. And they said, okay, great. Next year we came back and said, okay, pay for the study, and they did. And the study showed that at the very least, even if you make a lot of assumptions, which I think are ridiculous, they still showed, even assuming a free market model, which healthcare doesn't fit, they still showed that we could deliver healthcare to everybody at no more cost than we already have. So that should be enough incentive, but of course it isn't for a lot of politicians. So anyways, we kept up the fight, and then we got the legislature to authorize a task force to look at how they would design a system like this. And this time they paid for it right away. So they got to work, and it took them, I think, 2 years because of the pandemic. It was difficult to get started. But they're about to deliver their report on their recommendations for how we would run a system like that and how it would be paid for. Now, when that report is delivered, we're going to hit the ground running, because we already know legislatures who are going to support this, and we're going to work on legislation. We've been building those relationships. So we know for a fact they're going to start writing legislation in 2023. Now, best case scenario, they'll come up with something and they'll either vote on it or refer it to us in that session in 2023, the long session. Personally, I think that's pretty optimistic, because it's fairly complicated even after all this study to design one that's specific to Oregon or specific to a state at all. So, but our hope is that much sooner than a lot of people expect, we're going to be voting on it. Either the legislature will be voting on it or we'll be voting on it. And we will do it as an initiative if we have to, so we know it's going to happen. We just have to have that legislation. So it's a great time to jump in, and I think that the faith community plays a special role in this, which, again, I don't think I have to explain to you guys, because you understand that this is something you have to advocate for. It isn't going to help. It isn't going to happen on its own. It's not enough to just say, "Wow, I really support that. I'd like to have it happen." There are things that you can do to get involved. Oh, let me check my time. This is what happens when you don't practice. Oh, your phone shuts off. Oh gosh, I got lots of time. So, where was I? Let's see. Things you can do, yeah. Well, actually, I came up with a long list. I had to go through our website and dig up all this stuff, and I threw a few more things in. So I have it in one place now, and Karen can show that with you later. Did I send that to you already, Karen?
Send it again.
Okay, I will. And anyway, there's a lot of things you can do. Some of them are very, very simple, and other ones take a little more work. So let me just talk about the things you can do as a congregation first. That's a shorter list. One thing that you can do is help share our messages, action items, updates on what's going on with the legislation, just basic information. If we could put little short blurbs in your weekly bulletin, that's a big help. It'll educate you guys and let you know what you can do, remind you of some simple things, like simply going to our website and signing up as a supporter from the faith community. There's a way you can do that right from the front page. And I meant to bring a sign so you could pull out your phones and use the QR code, but you can go to the website too. So another thing that the congregation can do if they're interested. Now, I understand when I contacted Reverend Tracy, she told me that she passed this idea on to find out how many people were interested. And I believe she told me a dozen people responded. That's amazing in a congregation this size. And if even half of those people got involved, heck, if even one person joined Karen, he could form a committee, right? More than one person, it's a committee. We started with two in my congregation, and now we're a member. So, and there's lots of things a committee can do. Again, they can share information. They can put on presentations outside of services, bring in speakers, form study groups, form action groups. That's what we did in my church. We have a healthcare justice committee, and we've... coupled with the local Healthcare for All Oregon chapter in Albany and in the one in Corvallis, and put on some pretty good events. We got newspaper coverage. I know that's a lot harder to do in Portland than it is, or Portland area. What is your local paper besides the Oregonian? Do you have one that's specific to Washington County?
Pamphlet Media.
Pamphlet Media? Yeah. That
Hillsborough Argus.
The Hillsborough Argus, yeah.
Beaverton Valley Times.
So maybe you can make the smaller papers, and maybe you could make the Oregonian if you do something exciting enough. So anyway, that's one thing you can do if there's enough interest in the church. And it doesn't take a lot of people to put on certain things, like simply a street demonstration with signs, you know, just to remind people that this is a big issue. People are dying for lack of health care. It is a moral issue. Having grown up in Portland, I know that there's lots of people here who care, but they need to be reminded, and they need to be reminded that they can do something about it. And then finally, a congregation can, as I mentioned, join Healthcare for All Oregon or endorse it. It's a simple process. Once you come to agreement, I don't know what the procedure would be in my congregation in Roseburg, when I was living there, the board made the decision because they knew their congregation well enough. But anyway, that's up to you guys. But individuals, I mentioned one thing you can do, just sign our statement of support on the website. It's easy. You can become a member. Dues are $30 a year unless you can't afford it. Letters to the editor, easier for some than others, and not necessarily easy to get in the paper, but definitely worth the effort. Sam Netz can't be the only one publishing this stuff in the Oregonian. Let's see, what else? Well, like I said, I have that whole list. Oh, I almost forgot one of the most important things. As I mentioned, Karen is a member of the Faith Caucus, and I didn't really define that, did I? Oops. Glad I looked at my notes. The Faith Caucus is part of the membership committee for Healthcare for All Oregon. Our job is to enlist member organizations, like maybe this congregation, and individuals to join. But beyond that, to mobilize. So I've sort of been talking about that, beating around the bush about that mobilization. Get each of you who have the time and ability and interest to get you involved in these efforts. And again, I'll send Karen a whole list of things you can do if you want to find out what you can do and what fits your interests and abilities. So I guess that's it, because I didn't write this out. I can't think of anything else at the moment. Are there any questions? Yes, sir.
Hi, I'm John. Thanks for your talk. I was wondering whether or not your organization participates with the Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon in addressing their concerns to the Oregon Legislature.
Yes, we do. Actually, they're a member of our coalition, and we support their work, too. They're supporters of Measure 114. I'm pretty sure that we've endorsed that coalition as well. We do a lot of cross work like that. I mean, that's how you build a movement. To me, it's not just a movement for health care or a movement for gun control or whatever. It's one movement. It's about justice. So, yeah, we do that. And they published an article I wrote for Interfaith Voices, too. So let them know about the Faith Caucus. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
Hi, Spencer Ehrman. Who are the folks in the legislature that you're going to be looking to put forward the new legislation and be allies of the program?
Boy, I knew you were going to ask that once I said that. I'm not on the legislative side so much. I don't participate in that so much except to lobby my own members of the legislature. Mitch Greenlick was one of the people that really got this going, and unfortunately we lost him. The usual players. Some are more excited than others, but like I know Senator Golden will be supportive. Of course, Senator...
Steiner-Hayward.
Steiner-Hayward. Oh, my gosh. Salinas would have, but she's running for governor now, so I think she's probably not going to be involved. Pardon?
She's running for
U.S. Oh, I'm sorry, U.S. Congress, yeah. I try to track that stuff, but I get confused sometimes.
A follow-up. Assuming that it comes to referendum, which it, as you said, it likely will. Do you have any sense of how much money you're going to have to raise in order to overcome the fear-mongering that will take place from the other side?
Oh, not really. I'm not involved in the technical stuff. I'm more on the education side and mobilization. But, I think it depends, though, on how well we educate the public. And that's why I'm out here doing this. That's what I like to focus on. But it can't be just me going out to people that are willing to come to things like this. Fortunately, you're kind of a captive audience if you come regularly. But if I can convince you to get involved and do this evangelism, if you will, then that's how we educate other people. That's the biggest way. And that's why mobilization is so important, that I'm really glad I didn't forget to mention it. There was a question over here. I'm sorry?
We have this question.
Oh, I didn't see it. I'm sorry.
Before you jump into that, my name's Adrian, and I just wanted to hear some success stories. You know, it's a motivator to think about the difference that it's made so far. So if you have even small stories of success,
if you could be a little more specific about what you mean by success stories?
Just the efforts right now that have happened up to this point in time over the years. Are there, some stories of it's made a difference in this way?
Oh, gosh. To me the most obvious ones are the ones I just ran through, the successes we've had in the legislature. In terms of mobilization, I could talk about some of those successes. But since the Faith Caucus got restarted, actually just before the pandemic, we went from about 20 to 30 member organizations from the faith community. That's a big thing, because what we're trying to do, of course, is get a list long enough where people say, wow, the faith community is in favor of this, not just a few liberal congregations. And we're reaching out, it's interfaith. So we're reaching out not just to the easy pickings like UU, UCC, they're real easy. We're also reaching out to synagogues. We just got our most recent synagogue, and they're housed right up the street in Hillsdale, Pinayor. And now we're reaching out to the UCC church whose building they share. And it's getting easier and easier, honestly. I'm getting people calling me to speak, which is really cool. So like I just got a call to speak to a Rotary Club in Lebanon. You guys know Lebanon? Pretty red community, and these are businesses. Here's another easy thing you can do. If you're a business person, business owner, or you know one, they can sign up on the website as a supporter. That's another key constituency, along with the faith community. And unions, of course, are mostly already on board. Some of them don't want to give up the good health plans they fought for. But actually, unions are funding this current drive to pass a constitutional amendment declaring health care a fundamental right. So that's where some of this money is going to come from. So that's not pie in the sky either. That's a big accomplishment. Those are some examples. There are lots more depending on how you look at it.
That's what Gary's question is asking about.
Aha. Uh-huh. That's a great question. So will universal health care insurance primarily be a safety net for the uninsured? I already have excellent private health insurance. I wouldn't want to reduce the quality of my family's care. It will not be a safety net. It will replace private insurance. And that is because it's the only way to really pay for it, unless you want to be like Australia and pay for two systems. So, or have a second class backup for other people. Now, we have Medicaid. I mean, we could extend that to everybody, I suppose. But it's hard to get doctors to take Medicaid. The payment is so low. It's very comprehensive, though. It's actually more comprehensive than Medicare. Personally, if we had Medicaid for all and we improved payments to providers, that would be a pretty good system. Now, what we anticipate is that people won't have to give anything up, though, from their current insurance. Because it's so much cheaper to do this, it's possible to deliver a more comprehensive plan that still pays the doctors okay. I try to stay away from numbers, but the United States pays roughly twice as much as countries with universal health care for their total health care costs. And there's a bajillion reasons for that, but one of the leading reasons is insurance companies. Because we have multi-payer plans and we can throw them in with the VA and the Medicare and Medicaid and all this junk, it's so confusing and complicated, and people have to get reassessed for Medicaid, you know, to see if they still qualify, and they lose their job or their employer changes insurance companies, and it's constantly changing, and the rates go up and up because it's, you know, they're in for profit, not to make sure that you get care. And there's lots of stories you probably haven't heard about how excellent insurance fails you when you really need it. That's how they make their money, sorry. That's how Medicare Advantage makes its money. It's not Medicare in the way that it was designed to be. Medicare Advantage is a private plan, and it has all the problems of private plans. In 2020, an investigation showed that we overpaid by $12 billion, Medicare Advantage plans. That's over $1 trillion over 10 years. Remember how much the opponents of Bernie Sanders' plan said it would cost? About $1 trillion. Oh, my God, $1 trillion over 10 years. Well, we're already paying that much just for Medicare Advantage, which is only 40% of the Medicare population and a much smaller percentage of the entire population. Imagine if everybody were suddenly forced into that kind of Medicare for all, how expensive it would be. But the truth is, here's some big news. They're trying to make it worse. Instead of Medicare Advantage, they've got a new program called ACAO Reach, where they're going to have private contractors pay somebody to do what Medicare does with a 2% overhead. They're going to pay them up to 40% of what they pay out. That's outrageous. Medicare Advantage is 15%, and they're already overcharging. These guys, if they overcharge the same amount, they get to keep 40% of it. That's going to be hundreds of billions a year. Well, over $100 billion a year. Yes, sir? I mean, if that's Medicare for all, not if it's just all the Medicare patients, but if it becomes the form of Medicare for all. That kind we don't need, don't want. Yes, sir.
Thanks. I understand the importance of the funding side of it. Is your group doing anything on the other side of it, which is we are not training enough primary care physicians, and we're going to start running out, and like airline pilots, you cannot snap your fingers and create a primary care physician. Mm-hmm. So I realize that's a bigger ask, but are you doing anything in that regard?
Well, we don't have legislation, so I can't say. Has there been discussion? Absolutely. And I don't know specifically if the task force addressed that. I've only seen a summary of the main points of their draft recommendations, so that anything could happen. But that kind of thing is probably going to require federal involvement, because medical schools are, without the federal government throwing in money for medical schools, they can't tell them how many people are going to produce. They can't tell them that they need to produce more primary care providers. You could do that in a single-payer system, in a universal health care system, and they do that in some countries. But again, it's a matter of how much money we want to invest. We got a lot to play with if we're playing twice as much as everybody else. It just takes political will, and those are the kind of decisions we have to make. But honestly, I think that has to happen from a federal level. The only way it's going to happen in a state level is if the federal government says, okay, we'll do this with states. So ultimately, we want this for everybody in the country, and we are working for that. We're doing this in Oregon, but other people are doing it in other states. At least half of the states are doing something similar, working on state-based universal health care, and that's one way that we build the support for national health care. So, and we will need their help also with redirecting funds from Medicare and Medicaid, federal funds from Medicare and Medicaid into this state system. Without that, it isn't economically feasible. So I'll be honest, this may not happen at the state level, but that doesn't mean it's not worth working for, because we're doing this all over the country, and our ultimate goal is national universal health care.
I just wanted to ask, are your recommendations different for people who live in Washington than in Oregon for how to get involved, or are they pretty much the same?
Well, Washington has its own system, and as I understand it, they're not really working through the legislature now. Their emphasis, I mean, there is one group that is, but it's a smaller group. The bigger group, I can't remember if they're going for initiative or just focusing on education, but it's a little different. If you live in Washington, you want to contact, I think it's called Whole Washington or Healthcare for All Washington. I think those are the two major groups. But if you live in Washington and work in Portland and are paying taxes in Oregon, the task force is recommending those people be covered too, because this is going to be paid for through taxes one way or the other. Well, I know that we've got to our time, right?
We've got another question
from sure.
The chat.
Gary asked what assurances we would have. Well, I guess there's more than one question. Oh, my God, how high do I have to go here?
Looks like if universal health care is implemented in Oregon, over what period of time would citizens be able to transition from their private insurance?
That remains to be determined. That's an easy one. And that's one of those questions only the legislature can answer.
And then his last question is, what assurances would new universal health care subscribers have that their level of care and care responsiveness would be equal to or better than their private insurance?
Well, all I can say is just look at countries that already have this. The outcomes are much better. Wait times, some people talk about wait times in Canada, but again, that's a matter of where do you want to put the money. I mean, Canadians save enough money where if they wanted to spend more, they could have more specialists. Another thing about Canada is it's very rural. I mean, so it's almost like having a whole bunch of different healthcare systems all over the country. We wouldn't have as much of that kind of problem. So what assurance is that their level of care and care responsive? Level of care is going to depend on resources, too. So it depends. But one of the things about this is we can more rationally distribute resources. You don't need an MRI in every corner, right? Like a Starbucks. That's what we got now because these insurance companies are competing for business. Healthcare should not be a business. And care responsiveness, that goes back to your question, which is do we have enough providers? Well, we don't have enough now. And somehow we're going to have to deal with that, but I think it's the federal government. But will adding these new patients affect that much? That's debatable because these people are getting care now. They're just getting them in the ERs. Right? It's illegal to turn away somebody who shows up in the ER. It's a very expensive way to provide care. Preventative care is cheaper and ultimately cheaper and much more effective in taking care of a population's health. So that's all I can say. Gary, ultimately you have to take my word for it that we're going to do something comparable. We know it's been done at a national level, and yes, it will be harder on a state level. But certainly by the time we get the national plan, we'll be able to do it because we will have the resources. And it's going to take us letting our, you know, this is an ostensibly democratic country with representative government. That's what I was looking for. If they represent us, they have to know what we think, what we believe in order to do what we ask them to, you know. I'm not, again, I don't think necessarily that legislatures are crooked, certainly not in Oregon. It's, if we don't build a groundswell, they're not going to feel the pressure because they're certainly going to feel the pressure from their donors in the medical industrial complex. So hopefully that was meant to be inspirational. We can do this.
Thank you so much, Rick.
Carry the flame of peace.